Hello and welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Some Burien residents have gotten an unusual flyer in their mail recently. This flyer says, American citizens in Burien, yes, you have been cheated. There's a map on one side with a list of so-called illegal alien and gang criminals. Names and addresses are printed on the flyer with labels like murderer, drug dealer, and DACA rapist. This is what the King County executive, Dow Constantine, said about this mailer.
This letter demonizes local immigrants. It recklessly includes names and addresses. It is nothing but fear-mongering and intimidation, straight out of Trump's playbook. And I am furious.
KUOW's immigration reporter Liz Jones is following this. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Bill.
Now, Burien has a history of this debate over undocumented immigration. Will you remind us what has led up to this mailer?
Yeah, I'll give you sort of the Cliff Notes version here.
Mm-hmm.
So just for some context, Burien is about 20% Latino population. It's been growing in recent years. It's about double what it was 15 years ago. So that's just kind of setting the stage of who's there in Burien.
Mm-hmm.
The council has been in a heated debate over the past summer and last year about a sanctuary ordinance. This is a measure that would protect undocumented immigrants, limit how much local law enforcement work for them, this kind of a notion of police and government officials don't ask about someone's immigration status. Well, it really went through several rounds trying to get this approved in the Burien City Council, very heated debates, very vocal and upsetting public meetings for a lot of people. That did eventually pass the Burien City Council, and then a group called Respect Washington led an effort to repeal that. They got a petition going, got more than 3,600 people to sign a petition to try to repeal that sanctuary ordinance. That was about to go on the ballot for next week. And lawsuits cropped up both in Burien and in Spokane against this group and against the repeal effort. And a court eventually found that the petition, the effort to have a public vote on this issue of sanctuary, was beyond the scope of the initiative ordinance, or initiative process, rather. So that was overturned. But it just kind of shows Burien as sort of a microcosm of a larger immigration debate going on in our country as this unfolds.
Okay, so this so-called sanctuary city idea is not up for a vote here on Election Day. This group, Respect Washington, is frustrated. And what's the idea behind these mailers?
Right. So Respect Washington, they have a history in our area of pushing for legislation that pulls back some benefits for undocumented immigrants, would disqualify them for driver's license, not allow them to win lotteries, take away college financial aid, those kinds of things. So the founder of this group, Craig Keller, he said he sent out the petition for one thing, to update people who signed, or he sent out the mailer to update people who signed that petition that they are appealing this court ruling. That was one part of it. The second part was that he wanted to endorse a slate of candidates he felt were more in line with his views. And then we tried to ask him more specifically, why include this map of addresses of people and their alleged crimes? And this is what he had to say.
There was nothing but good and progress intended with this letter here in the height of election season, which gets a lot of people wrapped up. And, you know, there's a heightened interest, of course, because we as citizens want to have a say in our government. This is our main opportunity on Election Day.
Okay, so that's Craig Keller saying this is information. This is transparency.
Right.
Of course, some people don't see it that way, have a big problem with these mailers. What are their concerns?
Right. So we saw King County Sheriff John Urquhart is one of the first to publicly denounce these flyers and publicize what was happening. This came out late last week. He said it raises concerns about privacy. He raises concerns about the information, whether it's credible or not, that it could incite vigilantism of someone going to an address where maybe this person who was either charged or convicted of a crime no longer lives. Someone else could live there. So it just raises risks for people. It's inflammatory. And that's some of the concerns that have been raised about those flyers.
Well, one of the concerns you mentioned is credibility. So this flyer's got names and addresses and crimes supposedly committed. Where did Respect Washington get that information, and how credible, how accurate is it?
Yeah, and we haven't gone through all the reports, but Craig Keller says he pulled most of it from reporting in the Seattle Times, stories that had been reported of people who were in the country without legal status, who were charged or convicted of crimes, and lists their names and their addresses. They did block out the specific number of the address where people lived, so like an apartment number was redacted from the list he sent out.
Okay. And is it legal to send a flyer out with this information?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's law enforcement have said nothing appears to be unlawful. Craig Keller certainly feels that it's within his rights of free speech to do this. I asked a constitutional law expert here in Seattle about this, and he said if it's a question of whether they did have the right under the First Amendment, free speech, that's most certainly true. He said it's very few restrictions on free speech unless the information was defamatory or false in some way. Like, for example, if it named someone as a criminal when in fact they were not a criminal, or some other inaccuracy that really harms them. In theory, they could be charged afterwards if there were some real harm that came to a person. But it looks like it is within the bounds of free speech to send out a flyer like this.
And Liz, you also mentioned the idea of vigilantism. And in fact, you visited some of the houses that are printed on this mailer. What did people living there say to you?
Yeah, most people had no idea that their address was listed on this flyer. Some had even seen the stories in the news that this was going on in Burien, but didn't realize that their specific address had been called out. One person said he felt like it was a real violation of his privacy. He doesn't understand why somebody would do that. Why call out where I live on this map? And then another person, a Latino couple I talked to, was very reluctant to talk, said, you know, they're here legally, or they have lawful status here. They don't get involved in politics. They just had questions about why somebody would do this, but really wanted to stay out of it. Just, you know, leave us alone was kind of the feeling they had.
Yeah. And also you mentioned this part of this mailer had to do with endorsing some city council candidates who are running right now. Why did this person from Respect Washington, Craig Keller, why did he say he included these four candidates on his mailer?
You know, I don't know if we've got a clear answer for him or from that, but we have heard clearly from those four candidates that they are not at all affiliated with Craig Keller. They have denounced the flyers as well. So it's unclear if they had some relationship prior to this flyer going out, or were unclear of who, what each other represented. So from Craig Keller's point of view, I'm not sure why he targeted them, except seeing them as more sympathetic with his views potentially. But the candidates have clearly said we are not aligned with this thinking in this flyer.
And what about the people of Burien, Liz? You've talked to some of them about their reaction to all of this.
Right. It's caused a lot of uproar in the city, and this has been ongoing since the sanctuary issues have come up in the last several months. There was a house party last night, a group that's come out to support the sanctuary ordinance. They hosted a party to write letters to the people, to the addresses that were named in this flyer, and just to show support for them, that whoever you are, whether you're undocumented or not, that we welcome you, we support you, you are our neighbors here. The person who organized that house party, her name is Carrie Gibbard Klein, and she said she's lived in Burien just a year and a half, so she's fairly new there, but she's got friends and neighbors on her block who are Mexican-American, who she's seen negative things happen to them. And she talked just a little bit about that flavor of Burien that she's seeing crop up that is really disturbing and kind of gets to this division within the community.
There's folks here who have Confederate flags who drive down the street with their trucks. There's people who make death threats to our progressive city council candidates. My wife was putting out a Black Lives Matter sign earlier this year, and from the dark, from across the street, somebody shouted white power.
And just briefly, there were people at that party, at the letter writing party last night, who lived in Burien 40, 50 years. They go to all the city council meetings. They say they've never seen anything like this in Burien, this level of division, anti-immigrant rhetoric, and see a real opportunity with this upcoming city council race to chart a course for Burien about being inclusive and being progressive.
Yeah, really contentious times for Burien. What happens next? What are they looking for next?
Yeah, well, there is an election next week, and four city council seats are open or up for election. And it's really been somewhat divided in the community, too. For those four council members, there's been a slate, one on each side, one that's viewed a little bit more conservative, one that's viewed more progressive, and they've kind of got into two blocks, and people see that could be very, you know, a lot at stake in what Burien decides on, who represents them next.
KUOW immigration reporter Liz Jones is following this for you, and we'll, of course, check back in with you, Liz, as this develops. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Netflix says no more House of Cards. And this coincides with this weekend's BuzzFeed News report that actor Kevin Spacey allegedly climbed on top of a 14-year-old actor named Anthony Rapp at a house party in 1986 when Spacey was 26 years old, and Rapp was just 14 years old. Spacey has responded on Twitter, offered a qualified apology, and took the opportunity to break news about his own sexuality. He wrote, "As those closest to me know, in my life I have had relationships with both men and women. I have loved and had romantic encounters with men throughout my life, and I choose now to live as a gay man." And that part of Spacey's two-paragraph apology has not gone over well. Quote, "Kevin Spacey just invented something that's never existed before. A bad time to come out." That one from comedian Billy Eichner. David Schmader, writer, performer. Nice to see you again, David.
Hello.
Bad time to come out?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Will you help us untangle this?
Sure. This is so odd. This is one of those things where you don't hear much about an actor forever, and they say one thing that seems to just revolutionize everything you ever thought about them, and this is kind of how the Kevin Spacey was. I have a bit of a history with Kevin Spacey's sexuality. I went to North Carolina School of the Arts, this was in 1990, and the pre-Broadway run of Neil Simon's Lost in Yonkers played at my school. They usually would do that up in the East Coast. They would do that in Connecticut or something. They decided to do it at my school because we had a beautiful theater. Mm. So Kevin Spacey was in the cast, Mercedes Rule. So he was around for like 6 weeks and slept with two of my classmates. So we knew he was gay. And at this time, there were no out gay celebrities. This was the closest thing I knew to an out gay actor. And it was kind of like, oh, look, you can be an out gay actor. And the people he did sleep with they're totally of age, but definitely boyish. So
boyish, youngish.
Yes, my peers who look like 18-year-olds. Hmm. You know, which is fine. If you're wired that way, that's the way to live your life, is keep a 21-year-old bride around. They stay the same age. You stay. So Kevin Spacey was this I knew to be a functionally gay man, and it only got odd in the 90s when people started coming out, the Ellen era, Ellen DeGeneres, and Katie Lang, and he started denying everything. There was an Esquire article that was going to have a piece about his sexuality and it killed at the last minute, and he became really contentious about anyone who would bring up his homosexuality. And that's when I started thinking he was kind of a creep. I had never had any idea of him preying on actual kids. I feel horrible for Anthony Rapp. And then we get to this, don't pay attention to the alleged crime. Pay attention to this tender biographical fact of my life.
Okay.
It's the lamest deployment.
All right. Let's unpack that for a moment. You said something about Kevin Spacey being a creep. Are you saying solely because he didn't want people to know he was gay, he was a creep?
It was that and the fact that he was actively having homosexual sex. So dragging these other people into his lie, I don't think everyone has to be out. Jodie Foster really did not want to have her homosexuality part of her biography. And she lived a life that supported that. We never saw one of her girlfriends. She wasn't going around having sex with my college roommates.
That doesn't bother you?
No. Well, there was something where Kevin Spacey was availing himself of the gay community and shunning it and demonizing it. Like playing both sides in this really gross way that I hope will be dead now that people can come out in high school and have support systems. And I feel like he's just kind of one of those poison closet cases, and we're seeing exactly the insides of what that type is.
And so now to this Twitter reaction / apology, tell me what you saw going on in his saying, oh, and by the way, I choose this time to tell you that I'm living as a gay man.
I was flabbergasted. Of it's him making the actual connection between the idea that pedophilia and homosexuality are kind of parallel deviances from the norm, is it's the oldest, ugliest argument stereotype against gay people. And to hear it kind of bandied about or even alluded to in this way from an actual gay man was just shocking.
Well, I understand you making that connection. I just want to... So Kevin Spacey has been, I suppose, outed as being gay at the same time that, oh, this is was a 14-year-old and he climbed on top of him. I mean, is there an argument to be made that he's separately reacting to, well, since there's been these, you know, there's been these rumors, people who know me know, so I'm also... Otherwise, he would have ignored the fact that, oh, and this person I supposedly abused was a boy. And let me address that, too. There's no way he could have brought his sexual orientation up in that.
Maybe if there would have been a little bit more context about some of that. And this gets us into, like, the reporting on it.
Okay.
Of how when the headline was Kevin Spacey comes out, and you're like, that's not the story.
That's not the story.
The story is he used his coming out story, which was pretty common. I mean, that Esquire article was read by lots of people who proofed it up to the point. It was ready to go, and they killed it right at the last minute, just the part about his sexuality. So him just using this as a time to pretend he was coming out when he's been half out because of his actions and the fact that people talk to each other about who they've had sex with.
I've somehow known about Kevin Spacey for decades, and I don't know why I knew that, but it wasn't that big a secret.
Yeah, right? It wasn't. He never trotted around a bride or a fiance or anything. He was just Kevin Spacey, an awesome actor with kind of mysterious personal life.
Yes. And the bigger issue is, I think, here is this conflation that still must be not uncommon across America, right? So let's talk about that.
Yes, but I would say it was not uncommon, but I was so touched and heartened by Seattle's response to the Ed Murray allegations.
Mm-hmm.
This was not about Seattle's gay mayor molests same-sex child. It was Seattle's mayor accused of sexual assault. The division between his sexual orientation and his behavior, alleged criminal behavior, seemed really clear in society's mind in a way that I thought, oh my gosh, we've reached a wonderful new point where people, that old myth of gay people are a hair's breadth away from breaking every law.
Yes, if they'll do that.
Yes. Yeah. So that I'm coming into this with feeling really heartened from how we dealt kind of parsed the particulars of the Ed Murray scandal, and then to see just Reuters saying Kevin Spacey comes out as their headline, you're like, that's not it. You're a news organization. That's been really itchy, but nice to see other organizations calling them out and just the discussion around that would have been impossible 10 years ago.
And you were saying something about there's something special about an actor who wants to stay in the closet.
You probably think of Jodie Foster, and her, I tie it more to, like, she was a kid actor. Her whole life has been public, and if she has some weird thing she wants to keep just for herself, I can make concessions, especially when she comports herself in a way that isn't daring you to call her a liar every minute of the day.
Yeah. But you were saying it's kind of like lying to your therapist?
Oh, this. Okay. This was part kind of tied to me. At the time, I met Kevin Spacey when I was an acting student, and I was closeted, and that seems like lying to your therapist, being a closeted person learning how to act, and I was just like a pile of lies. I was closeted lies, and now pretending to be the guy in Picnic from William Inge Lies, and that kind of seems that's where it's seeing, oh, look, he's an actor, and he has homosexual sex happily. And there was this kind of hope that Kevin Spacey might be like a Katie Lang figure, especially because he's oddly butchy. I don't know, not butchy, but like he plays mobsters. He plays everyone. Like to have that type be...
That matters?
It's just more surprising than... I mean, because we had... I don't know, I'm trying to think of who the gay actors were. They were always... Well, it was like Paul Lynde. It was like big... wads of stereotypes.
Yeah, Nelson Reilly.
Yeah, just having, like, that's why people get excited when successful athletes come out. Anything that'll challenge the stereotype
right.
is just a little more interesting.
Right.
I think it's also why we all kind of laughed when Barry Manilow came out, because we're like, cute.
Well, you know, Kevin Spacey's old, and you and I are aging, and maybe this conversation looks really different to a millennial who's head scratching over the whole thing, maybe?
The idea of like, why I hope that we'll have to like explain the closet to them like we explained the Civil War. I hope we do a better job than Kelly.
The Civil War and Kelly.
Oh, John Kelly just did some contentious descriptions of the causes of the Civil War that are...
Thank you. You're up on the news and culture more than I am, yes.
It's all Twitter.
It's all Twitter. Well done. Okay, so finally, what's this about? What do you want us to remember about the Kevin Spacey affair, or would you rather this where we could push a forget button?
I feel like there's going to be a bit of a forget button. I'm like the step that Netflix took is really strong. I think the story will be like Kevin Spacey is a very odd man who happens to be gay and might have been a sexual predator, but he just mostly seems like a very valuable evidence of a very particularly tortured closet case.
Let's talk about it that way. Okay, David Schmader, it's great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Writer David Schmader, what are you working on now?
I'm full-time at Leafly. I am in the writing about cannabis.
Yeah.
And writing a lot about cannabis in Canada, which is legalizing it on July 1st. So it's this whole nationwide thing. So
you're probably getting fielding inquiries from one state after another as this sweeps the country.
We do have some precedent to show.
David Schmader, good to see you again. Thanks. It's The Record, back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Ever since allegations of sexual harassment and assault against Harvey Weinstein surfaced, there's been a deluge of women speaking out about their experiences in the workplace, and this includes state capitals. Several women who worked at the Washington state capitol say they have experienced groping and other unwelcome behaviors by men over the past decade. These women agreed to speak to KUOW and the News Tribune of Tacoma. Joining us now is our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Welcome, Austin.
Thanks for having me.
What did you find?
Well, we spoke with 9 women. They are, as you said, current and former legislative staffers and lobbyists. All but 2 of them agreed to speak to us only if we agreed to protect their identity out of concern for their careers. The 2 that did agree to let us use their names are no longer working in Olympia. They are former state representative Justin Farrell, who ran for Seattle mayor, and Nicole Grant of the King County Labor Council. All of these women said they had endured unwelcome attention from men while working at the Capitol. This includes for male lawmakers and for male lobbyists. For the most part, it was comments about their appearance. It was physical touching, like a hand on the lower back or a massage that they didn't want, or a lingering hug. Other times it was more than that. Both Farrell and Grant said that they had been groped or touched on their behinds. Here's Grant describing an encounter she had back in 2011 with a Democratic lawmaker who was no longer at the Capitol following a meeting in his office.
Right as I was stepping out the door, he gave my ass like a little pat or something, like a little slap. I just remember being like, what? And turning around and just looking at him in complete shock and just being like, I need to get out of here.
We heard a similar story from former state representative Justin Farrell. She said that a lobbyist grabbed her in the rear in the hallway. And she said she was so shocked and embarrassed by this that she didn't say anything at the time. And later, neither she nor Grant reported these incidents. And that was a theme with all of the women that we spoke with.
In fact, we're going to hear from Justin Farrell in just a moment. She's going to be in our studio. Why did these women tell you they did not report these actions?
The answer to that question is no different if you're working in the state capitol or anywhere else. What we heard is a combination of there's no clear place to go, especially if you are a lobbyist, because there's no formal organization or structure. We heard over and over again concern about the fallout and the blowback if they complained. These, especially for the lobbyist corps, they need access to lawmakers to do their job. There is concern that they will lose clients, that they will lose their businesses, that they will get a reputation as someone that you can't meet alone with if they complain about this. There are a lot of young staffers around the Capitol, and they were afraid of complaining because there's no guarantee of confidentiality, and they were concerned about their future advancement career-wise.
Well, what would the process be if somebody did want to report inappropriate behavior?
The House and the Senate both have very strict anti-harassment policies. They also have procedures in place for addressing violations, ways to do that informally and formally. The House and Senate actually have separate processes. Right now, the Washington House is in the midst of reviewing its policies and procedures. This is following a sexual harassment scandal in the Tennessee legislature. So you can go to the caucus, you can go to the administration in the House or Senate, you can try to address these things informally with the person you think whose behavior is a problem, or you can file a formal complaint. But once again, we were routinely hearing that from the staff and from the lobbyists that they saw no real percentage in proceeding with this process as it's laid out.
And what did women tell you it is about the legislature that makes this behavior tough to address?
We heard over and over again the legislature described as a summer camp for adults. Keep in mind that the legislature convenes every year. In even years, it's for 60 days. In odd years, it's for 105 days. People are away from their homes. It's not a traditional 9-to-5 work environment. In fact, there are a lot of after-hours and off-campus events, some of them hosted by interest groups, some of them just at the bars. And there are late nights on the floor where people are still at the Capitol late into the evening. So an untraditional or non-traditional work environment, and then a tremendous power differential between the lawmakers and the staff who work here and the people who need access to the lawmakers to get something done.
Austin, I assume you know the name of that Democratic legislator who's behind padding you described, but you're not naming names of lawmakers or lobbyists who these women say acted wrong. Why is that?
This is true, and the reality is that, once again, there are no, as far as we know, no formal complaints or investigations, or if there are, we have not been able to obtain them from the Washington legislature because they have denied our public records requests. And in fact, we're part of a lawsuit now challenging that denial. If there are records, we'd like to see them and obtain them. But at this point, there have not been formal complaints or investigations or reports to the police that we have found involving these individuals. So at this point, we are not naming them.
Okay, no formal complaints, no reports to the police. And we're going to continue our conversation with one of the women who has a story to tell. This is KUOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Austin, thank you for your reporting on this.
You are welcome.
Now, with me in the studio is, as I say, one of these nine women who told their stories. Former Democratic state representative representing Seattle, Jessen Farrell. Welcome back.
Hello there.
Would you mind telling us what happened to you?
Sure. One story is that I was walking back to my office in the John L. O'Brien building, and a lobbyist just pat me on my behind, and it was shocking when it happened.
Shocking. And Austin mentioned your story briefly and said that you told him you didn't react toward the patter in the moment. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly wasn't expecting that. And so in that moment, I almost questioned that it happened. But, you know, it definitely happened. And that hand was on my behind. But, you know, I had a meeting to get to. I had things that I had to do. I had bills to pass. And it certainly wasn't going to be something that I spent a lot of time on in that moment.
And what was going through your mind in the moments afterward? What were you thinking?
Again, I was shocked that it happened in the workplace. You know, I also felt a little ashamed. I think so often with these stories and these things that happen, women internalize it. You know, that initial thought was, did I do something wrong? And, you know, obviously I didn't, but that is a thought that crossed my mind in that moment. And then it was to just move on. You know, this is just, these things happen and just get back to work.
That's remarkable to me that you would even have the thought, did I do something to bring this on? I can't imagine what that would be or that you would do it. You know what I'm saying? But that you're saying that's a very common thought that pops up?
I think it is. And I'm trying to be a little more focused on when I have that kind of thought, because we need to interrupt that thought pattern, right, that a woman would feel shame when she was inappropriately touched. But I think that that is so deeply common when we read all of these Me Too stories. I think that that really is a common theme, and that's one of the reasons why we collectively haven't been having these conversations in the same way that we suddenly are now.
Well, as you heard, one thing that holds back telling a fuller story here is that people aren't naming names. Why aren't you naming the name of the person who touched you?
These are really big issues. You know, I think one thing I'd love to do is talk to some of the other women. It's potentially a career-wrecking thing to say, and it's a he said, she said story, and we know too often what happens in those he said, she said stories. The she said part of it is discounted, even though I'm a former legislator, even though in that moment I was a legislator. You know, it is a really, and you don't want to rock the boat. You want to get your work done. You know, you're down there to get work done, not to, you know, hold someone accountable for something like that. That's not why the people of the 46th District sent me down there. You know, it was to pass important policy legislation. So I think part of it is that feeling of, you know, again, internalized, not wanting to rock the boat, but also this fear that I won't be believed.
Well, this might be personal to you. You don't have to answer it, but you're a former legislator now. Do you still feel like you have something to risk by naming the name of this person?
Well, what's interesting is I told a lot of the stories that I told to Austin were in the Seattle Times a year ago. And it was a story that was run about me and former Governor Gregoire and Barbara Madsen. And at that time, my attitude was, you know, these are battle scars. This, you know, unfortunately is, you know, just it happens and we accommodate it. You know, I think a lot of the stories that that Austin was retelling are accommodations that women make, you know, whispering to other women, avoid that particular lawmaker, avoid that particular legislator. And, you know, the process for me internally right now is no more accommodations, but it still is that big test and a big risk to take to name a name. And, you know, it's part of a process. And for me right now, it is really important. You know, it's not fun to be on the radio about this particular topic, I will say. It was a lot more fun to be on the radio last week with you.
Yes.
But part of it is that, you know, let's at least start calling it what it is. And that was really inappropriate, what happened to me and what happens to other women.
As you say, you told that story to the Seattle Times. And what was the reaction then?
Well, I think the thought was, at least amongst my colleagues, was Jessen knows how to advocate for herself. You know, if anybody does, she's going to say something about it. And again, I think that, as I mentioned just a couple minutes ago, my attitude was go get the job done, keep going. And, you know, and I didn't even really tell anyone at that, you know, a couple of years ago when that happened about it happening, in part because I, you know, just all of the different feelings that happen around something that one of the most prevalent ones is to disconnect from that feeling and just get the work done.
And what about since then? What has changed for you since you told that story a year ago?
The Me Too hashtag has had a profound impact, I think, on so many of us. Just that very public coming out of almost universally of women suffering from a whole continuum of behaviors that are offensive, from words and looks to touches to rape. And, you know, seeing my friends and colleagues and, you know, over and over and over again on Facebook come out and say Me Too really had a profound impact. And, you know, Me Too.
Well, thanks for coming in and talking with us about it. I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
In Austin's reporting, he mentioned, he quoted women saying that there are work parties in Olympia that you're told not to attend because, you know, men there are going to try to get you drunk. And I wonder how much does that hold back women's careers that they can't be at these even casual functions where business connections happen?
Well, I will say that so much of sexual harassment is about power. And one of the really difficult things about Olympia is there is a really deep power differential. And as a legislator, I was generally on the other side of that power equation. Still,
meaning staffers and lobbyists.
Yeah.
Who are...
So no one ever said that to me. Mm. I don't have firsthand of that kind of conversation, which isn't to say that those conversations don't happen. I was talking about the accommodations women have to make to be able to get that job done. And what's on my mind around this is, you know, there was some talk about Republican senators maybe in Washington, D.C., saying they won't take a meeting with a single woman or a woman alone, something
like
that.
Vice President Mike Pence, I think, says he doesn't have a drink or go to a dinner with a woman unless his wife is there.
Exactly. And that is a huge problem because the currency of that job is being able to have confidential conversations, exchange information, make deals. You know, you can't be able to do that without having a degree of trust. And if someone is going to touch you inappropriately, say something inappropriately, make you feel uncomfortable, it is really hard to get that job done. And so we do need to modernize attitudes down there so that women are truly on equal footing.
Justin, I wouldn't be surprised if there are people who work in Olympia listening to us right now, maybe people who've even been inappropriate. Do you think any of these men are unaware that they did wrong? They think they're just given a compliment. Or do they all know full well?
Well, I think that...
Or they're just, I'm just patting her reassuringly, et cetera.
So again, there's a continuum, but I think that the fundamental element of sexual harassment is about power and diminishing women's power. And that is usually the thread that ties all of these stories together. I can't say, sure, there are some people who, you know, may pat you on the shoulder and say, honey, right? And maybe that's, you know, not the most respectful word to use. But so maybe there is a little bit of a continuum. But deeply, we need to understand that sexual harassment is about power. And it's about diminishing women's power. And that on the one hand, there are a lot of men down there who are allies and who would never dream of doing something like that. And I think the step that has to be taken down there is to now say publicly, and we're not going to tolerate any of this. And that is a real change. Not just to have rules and regulations and some kind of, you know, disciplinary process, which are often really, really hard for women to go through, but a real culture shift where men are really stepping up and saying, and we're not going to tolerate this. There are a lot of public platforms in Olympia, you know, in the State of the Union address, for example, from the governor, something like that, where, you know, someone could say, we're not tolerating this anymore publicly. I think that would be very powerful.
Justin Farrell was, up just until recently, a state legislator representing Seattle, a Democrat in Olympia, and she's one of the women, one of the two women who offered her own name as part of this reporting. Nine women, seven of them spoke anonymously to Austin Jenkins in the News Tribune. Justin, thanks for telling us your story and talking about power and politics and how it's not okay, what's going on. Thank you. It's The Record. We'll be back in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. You know, before fake news, before alternative facts, there was The Daily Show's resident expert, John Hodgman. He's the guy who would make stuff up about, say, an American president and say it with a straight face.
Take Abraham Lincoln. Before every major Civil War battle, Lincoln consulted a personal religious advisor whose name was Phineas Gurley.
Now, all right. That name sounds made up.
No, that's a real person, but he got that a lot. Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, also had a spiritual advisor, name of Greasy Face Q McFancy Dancer.
John Hodgman, still funny, but he's not an expert anymore. His new book, Vacation Land, is a collection of personal stories about living in Maine and getting older and feeling irrelevant. He told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel why he wanted to move on from fake facts.
Part of my retreat from fake facts is that even when I was doing them, it was never enough to simply say something absurd to get a laugh. There had to be in the fake fact some kernel of truth, or of honesty, or reflection of truth, when I wrote my list of the nine U.S. presidents who had secretly had hooks for hands as a joke, and I wrote about how Franklin Roosevelt had a hook for a hand, but no one knew about it because he was always photographed from the wrist up. That was a reflection of the fact that there was this mutual understanding among the press that no one would ever talk about the fact that Franklin Roosevelt was disabled. He had polio and he needed a wheelchair, and there was an illusion based around him. Mm. And I never wanted to do stuff that was just absurd. And now when we're in a place where facts are disputed left and right, it felt it didn't feel like a mission. Again, I just did what I had to do, but it felt like the most honest thing I could do was just be honest and hope that that resonated.
There is a lot there that sounds like you wrote it from Seattle. You talk about trying to prove your relevance by what music you like and running into your 90s music hero in town and keeping yourself from gushing over how much his music meant to you. I mean, you even talk about marijuana edibles. Are you planning to move here?
Well, I don't want to have to ruin your delusion, but not everything is about Seattle.
What?
I know that Seattle feels very strongly that it is. Seattle is very much like me in that regard. I grew up as an only child, thinking the entire universe was organized around what I thought was interesting and cool. But in fact, I had to learn, as the book is largely about, that the universe is not organized around me, and that I am just one atom in a million spilling through existence. That is what Seattle is too.
The book is basically about you coming to terms with the fact that you're not the center of the universe. So are you comfortable with that understanding now, or are you still struggling with it?
I don't think it would be fair to say that I've ever been comfortable at all from childhood into what is now my middle adulthood. But I have come to accept a few difficult truths, one of which is that I am no longer young, but in fact am middle-aged, that I have a beard that looks terrible and it will never look better. Now that I've grown it and see what it looks like, I realize that I look like either the IT guy for the Church of Satan or the part-time bookkeeper for the Duck Dynasty. But in life, we grow the beards we can, metaphorically speaking, of course, and you have to come to some acceptance of where you are in life and who you are in life if you're going to be anything that resembles comfortable and happy. Sometimes you just have to accept you're not comfortable, and I never, ever am.
The notion of being uncomfortable in your own skin comes up a lot in the book, and that sort of almost sneakily moves into this discussion of you calling out your own privilege. I was surprised to see that come up so much, particularly in the second half of the book. Why was that important to you to do? Why did you want to do that?
Well, it was John Roderick, the great citizen of Seattle, my dear friend, lead singer of the Long Winters.
City council candidate, yes.
Former city council candidate, and I still believe future mayor of Seattle, who back announced me when we were both performing in Santa Fe a couple of years ago, and I started telling some of these stories, these new straightforward personal stories on stage that I was telling, and I just thought I was telling the story of my life, not thinking very much more about it than that. And John got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the white privilege comedy of John Hodgman." And I was, it was like I jumped into cold water. I'm like, oh, of course, that's what's going on here. I mean, the definition of privilege is in some way you don't realize you have it, and when it's revealed to you, it's embarrassing. And I realized, oh yeah, this is in some level a comedy show at that time, and now a book. The central dilemma of which is, I now own two summer homes. Mm-hmm. Are you enjoying my relatable comedy? But then I realized, you know, you only grow the beard you can grow in life, and my weird fates and fortunes have led me to where I am, and I don't feel I want to apologize for who I am in life, but it's important to be aware of the privilege you have and to not ignore it. And that there is a moment in the book that reflects a very real and sobering moment from a couple of summers ago when I was in Maine, and you know, it was midsummer, and I was enjoying myself and relaxing in the painful state that also happens to be one of the most Caucasian states in the nation. And The news about the police shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling came in quick succession, and the Black Lives Matter protests that emerged from that and the rather unseemly and dumb counter protests online suggesting that that you can't say that Black Lives Matter because it somehow diminishes the power and privilege of white people. I mean, I couldn't figure out what they were trying to say, but it was weird. And there I was, processing all of this pain and anger and frustration, and realizing very distinctly that I could just close my computer and walk away, and walk away, and not have to, and turn off the whole concept of race, because where we were in coastal Maine is so profoundly Caucasian that I wouldn't have to think about race at all, and that is an incredible privilege. I don't want to say that there are no people of color in our town. There are, but statistically speaking, I was capable of experiencing a kind of blind, dumb delusion that I was default humanity that is rapidly and rightly disappearing in an increasingly multicultural world. And it was time to stop thinking of myself as normal, a normal person for whom race is a conversation you have every now and then at an enlightened dinner party, but appreciate that race and privilege, point of view, oppression, and all of those issues that people who don't look like me live within their skin every day, I have to live with it in my skin too and be open to the criticism that people might throw at me without throwing up big defenses saying, well, all lives matter, don't they? Like that kind of sophomoric bull feces has to end.
So what does that look like for you, that awareness, especially given the fact that, as you said, you don't really have to think about it if you don't want
to? Right. But I mean, I do have to think about it and I do have to make efforts to educate myself. But I think mostly my job is to get out of the way of other voices, which is a weird thing to say when you're being interviewed on a radio to,
yes,
to promote a book that you wrote. One of my heroes is the writer E.B. White, whom I knew of obviously from Charlotte's Web, but only more recently in my life began to appreciate his work as an essayist, writing about his normal life in Maine. And he was writing about a very white world. It's right there in his name. But it was his life. Every life is worth writing about. But E.B. White was special because for all the white dudes that I've ever read, E.B. White was perhaps the least braggy. He was a guy who, when people would come to see him after he was already sort of famous at the New Yorker, he didn't want fame or even appreciation for what he did. He needed to write what he had to write. He offered it humbly, and then he wanted to disappear. And when people came to visit him, he literally got out on the fire escape and ran away.
Wow.
That, I think, is the model that if you're a creative person who looks like me and a straight white man of some affluence now thanks to television, you know, I have to offer what I have to offer. That's all I got. I can only grow the beard that I can grow. All I can do is offer it humbly, and when it's some time for someone else to talk, get out of the way. I guess you enjoyed hearing a white man explain all of that to you. You're welcome. There's no mansplaining like white mansplaining, because white mansplaining don't stop.
Thank you very much for explaining all of that to me. Fine, but
oh, you're welcome.
But you're also
someday maybe you'll have something to say too. We'll see.
We'll see
how it goes. Yeah. So, but it's a delicate balance because, you know, there's part of me that literally would like to just disappear into the woods. You know, white culture has imagined of itself default humanity against which every other culture, race, religion, creed, whatever, personhood is considered exotic or strange or other. That's all changing, right? Whiteness is facing a midlife crisis because we know, if we don't know, we sense that we're no longer going to be a majority culture in this nation. We're soon going to be a minority among many. And people that are having a hard, it's just like middle-aged dads who want to admit they're still cool. Like, you know, like there's like, you know, white people who fight against what is inevitable, which is the increasing diversity of this nation. They're as sad as a dad buying a Bentley. It's so sad. When those awful dudes marched in Charlottesville chanting, "Jews will not replace us, you will not replace us," like, I felt a really horrible, dark middle-aged white guy echo whenever I meet a young comedian, which is, you're not going to replace me. I still got jokes. Mm. Fact is, we'll all be replaced. And there's a value in getting out of the way. And part of me wishes I could just get out of the way and disappear into Maine, into the darkness, and maybe I should. But I still have things I want to say, and I still have bills to pay. So you're going to get some of this anyway.
John Hodgman's new book is called Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. He talked with Ginny Yandel, and you can hear more Hodgman. He'll be on stage at Seattle First Baptist Church on Saturday night talking with the Seattle citizen that he mentioned before, John Roderick. We're sharing a link for tickets with you right now on Twitter, at KUOW.